Hello, and thank you so much for joining me. I'm Nancy Rowe, and you are listening to Liver Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights. Today, I am so fortunate to have our good friend Chris Cowley joining us to discuss cholestasis. So, Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in cholestatic liver disease?
Thank you, Nancy. It's a pleasure to be with you in this program. I'm Chris Cowdley, director at Liver Institute Northwest and senior scientific advisor and medical director at Velocity Clinical Research, and also a professor at Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine, Washington State University. I was interested in cholestasis really starting from my fellowship. I had the good fortune of training with Dr. Marshall Kaplan, who was really one of the fathers of PBC. And a funny anecdote, we got to work with Dr. Kaplan in his clinic in the second year of fellowship, and he had over 1,000 PBC patients and over 1,000 PSC patients, or 500 PSC patients at least. And so the clinic was just full of PBC and PSC, cholestatic liver disease. So we came out of fellowship thinking that was the most common liver disease. And so lo and behold, my first job at Case Western Reserve University set up my shingle and said, I'm ready to see patients with PVC and PSC. That's my specialty. Well, you can imagine what happened. So it's been an interesting journey. I've been involved in the care of patients with PVC and PSC really for my entire professional career, and have been involved in both translational research in PSC, focusing on the relationship between colon dysplasia and surveillance for colon cancer and PSC associated with IBD. We had a great team when I was at the University of Washington with Dr. Cy Rubin, who was a legend of morphology and histopathology in GI. And we characterized sort of optimal surveillance techniques for patients with PSC, did one of the earliest studies with chemo prevention, and also characterized the optimal endoscopic surveillance back when I used to do ERCP as part of my clinical practice. And then also was involved in clinical trials in PBC from the very beginning, a landmark study which really did not get a lot of attention, funded by the NIH, was a study, the PUMPS trial, which was a 9-year urso methotrexate compared to urso placebo trial. And it really highlighted a lot of the interesting challenges in dealing with PBC, which is in designing therapeutic trials is very, very important to have optimal patient selection. And if you identify patients who are too early in the stage of the disease, you're unlikely to show therapeutic benefit with any therapy. Whereas if you identify patients who are in an advanced stage of the disease, your therapy is unlikely to work. So it's been an interesting journey. And what's really exciting is that we went from no therapies that were approved for PBC to being involved in the first approval for PVC, which is ursodeoxycholic acid, which was approved using a pathway that may not even work today, which is essentially a combination of three data sets from Raoul Poupon in Paris, Jenny Heathcote in Toronto, and the Mayo Clinic database. And they had the Goldilocks combination of patients who were sufficiently advanced, but not so far advanced that URSO was shown to improve transplant-free survival. And that led to URSO being approved in the late 90s. And since then, I've been involved very actively in therapeutic trials and in also defining risk stratification for PBC. So this has been through the Global PBC Study Group, which was really a landmark collaboration starting in Rotterdam and has really become a global organization and has been particularly useful as a great platform for developing and mentoring junior faculty, many of whom have now become established PBC investigators. So we showed for the first time that alkaline phosphatase was a useful surrogate In 2014, there was a paper led by Wim Lammers, who was a PhD student in Rotterdam. And this showed for the first time that not only are we able to predict transplant-free survival over the short term using older models like the Mayo model, we're also able to show over a 15-year time period the utility of bilirubin and alkaline phosphatase in predicting transplant-free survival. So those data were really impactful in that they were used to achieve the second therapy approved for PBC, which was sobeticholic acid, which was approved in 2016. And I participated in the FDA advisory committee that led to OCA's approval. And it was a very important development for a number of reasons. One is that it was, as I mentioned, the first time that a surrogate endpoint in a non-viral disease was actually accepted as a surrogate reasonably likely to predict clinical benefit. Of course, that remained, that left open the need for a confirmatory clinical trial showing that that surrogate, in fact, correlated with improved clinical outcomes. Interestingly, it's been 9 years since the approval of OCA using this pathway as a conditional approval, and we still don't have any medications that are fully approved to treat PBC as second-line therapy. A great deal of additional research has happened in the meantime where we've characterized long-term surveillance strategies, non-invasive ways of staging the liver disease, identifying new ways of making the diagnosis of PBC, et cetera. And I've been privileged to be sort of front and center in a lot of these developments. So it's been a great journey. And I think most importantly, I think it's been really helpful to our patients in having a range of therapeutic options to treat this progressive and previously, uniformly, if not fatal, definitely debilitating chronic liver disease.
Well, thanks, Chris. That's an amazing overview and, really shows the legacy that you've contributed to cholestasis. I want to bring out just one of the first points, and that's that we have now defined biochemical response. So unlike when you probably were first working on PBC, where we were hoping for endpoints, we now know, as you said, that that surrogate led to the conditional approval of abetacolic acid and now our other second-line agents. That's also translated to our guidelines. So for the audience, why don't you just tell me a little bit about where we've moved that goalpost? At what point do you expect to see a change in those numbers and why that might be different than what you might have been looking at 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, very timely question. So the guidelines, as you know, having been involved in guidelines, they are often a very methodical and somewhat Byzantine process. And so often guidelines are behind where the cutting edge is in the field. And so we've circumvented this challenge by having consensus statements, meeting summaries, and other sorts of white papers and monographs that have helped us to sort of keep abreast of the latest developments in the field. So I would say the current guidelines or guidances, depending on which term you prefer, are probably a little bit behind where the cutting edge is in the perception of what is the optimal approach to treat PBC. There will be a new guidance or guideline that will be emerging, and I believe that's going to be a combined effort from several societies, such as the AGA, the ASLD, et cetera. But the European guidelines and the American guidelines are a little bit out of date, given how quickly the field has moved. So if you look at more recent contributions, such as the 2023 American Journal of Gastro consensus paper, which I had the opportunity to lead, and others, you can see that the thinking is really evolving, and where the thinking is evolving is to really achieve a biochemical response that is beyond just lowering the alkaline phosphatase to less than twice upper limit of normal or less than 1.67 times upper limit of normal, which would be the old Toronto criteria. Because we now know, based on recent data, that, and this a lot of this comes from UK PBC and the Global PBC Study Group, we now know that, in fact, modeling and actual data shows us that patients who maintain an alkaline phosphatase less than one times upper limit of normal, so in the normal range, with a normal bilirubin, have the best outcomes. And in fact, their expected life expectancy, if you will, is not different than the general population. So, for myself and for those of us that are seeing and caring for a lot of PBC patients, that resonates because why should we settle for half of the optimal biochemical response? Certainly when we treat autoimmune hepatitis, which I'm sure you treat a lot of, we are not satisfied when the ALT is 1.5 times upper limit of normal or twice upper limit of normal. We want to achieve a complete biochemical remission. And I think there's no reason why we should not expect to do the same in cholestatic liver disease. One of the reasons is that we really haven't had therapies that have been able to achieve a complete biochemical response. But now with several new therapies available, which are now showing the ability to normalize alkaline phosphatase, we can actually hold this as a therapeutic goal to strive for. So based on recent data, we have now really changed our consensus thinking to achieve an alkaline phosphatase that is at least 1.5 times upper limit of normal at most, and ideally within the normal range. Now, similarly, there is growing data that a bilirubin of 0.6 milligrams per deciliter or 0.6 times upper limit of normal is a threshold above which negative outcomes may occur. So achieving a bilirubin less than 0.6 and maintaining a normal alkaline phosphatase, I think allows the patient to have the best opportunity for a good prognosis. The other thing that's changed is all second-line therapies have been following a fairly well-trodden pathway, which is, as I mentioned, the Toronto criteria of 1.67 times upper limit of normal for alkaline phosphatase with at least a 15% reduction, maintaining a normal bilirubin, and entry criteria for these studies and in clinical practice is to wait 1 year after we've treated the patient with UDCA and then determine whether they're a candidate for second-line therapy. And it is now clear from, again, Global PBC Study Group that, in fact, patients should be assessed at 6 months after starting UDCA because if they have a bilirubin, if they have an alkaline phosphatase that is above 1.9 times upper limit of normal, say rounded up to twice to make it simple to remember, they're very unlikely to achieve that biochemical response we seek at 1 year. So another way in which the guidelines may change is to suggest that we should assess treatment response to UDCA at 6 months instead of at 1 year, and based on the patient's response, consider additional therapies. Another new development has been the introduction of transient elastography, and a lot of this work has been led by Christophe Corpechot in Paris, and various centers that have contributed to really a wonderful and useful database. And I'm sure you're going to mention that the FDA has accepted a letter of intent looking at a transient elastography as a potentially useful biomarker and a surrogate for predicting clinical outcomes. So that's encouraging because we have very robust data in PBC showing that thresholds of 8, 10, and 16 kilopascals are useful to differentiate patients who have some fibrosis to moderate to advanced fibrosis to likely cirrhosis, and those numbers are strongly predictive of adverse clinical events. So another consideration in making the choice of second-line therapy or possibly even third-line therapy is or triple therapy is what is the patient's stage of disease in conjunction with their biochemical parameters. And increasingly, I consider the incorporation of staging as well as biochemical tests as important considerations in determining when we should consider second-line therapy. And then finally, I'll mention that from a treatment perspective, with the goal of achieving this complete biochemical remission, there is a growing amount of data suggesting that triple combination therapy using an FXR agonist and possibly a PPAR agonist or a fibrate might in fact be useful in achieving that biochemical remission in a majority of patients with hitherto has not really been possible. So I know I just downloaded an enormous amount of data here, so I'll let you come back with follow-up questions.
Yeah, so I think that that's really highly important to understand that there are lots of treatment options and combining them may not be the same in all of our PBC patients. And it's going to be that algorithm or that assessment of response as to how you and when you add things. I would like to come back to that, though, because we just lost one of our tools, right? Abetacolic acid was withdrawn just recently. And so how are you approaching those individuals now that might be on an out-of-date or no longer existing option, such as abetacolic acid, or a person on a fibrate as a PPAR as opposed to the two PPARs that are now conditionally approved for PBC?
Yeah, and what you're referring to, of course, is the voluntary withdrawal of obeticholic acid as second-line treatment for PBC following discussions with the FDA that just literally happened this week. And it certainly caught a lot of us by surprise. And it's not a it's not completely unexpected. The FDA has raised concerns in the past about the safety of the medication, and certainly as a hydrophobic bile acid, it is important to understand how to use this drug appropriately. Now, I think it will be challenging because there are many of us who feel that with the appropriate level of monitoring and surveillance that can be done by an expert caring for patients with PBC who knows how to manage, evaluate, follow up, triage, and counsel patients with liver disease and has the ability to detect hepatotoxicity, has the ability to identify which patients have cirrhosis. Obeticholic acid can be safely used, and certainly having a different mechanism of action compared to PPARs. It provides a very attractive therapeutic strategy in terms of having multiple mechanisms of action. And in fact, as a proof of concept, we know from the combination studies of bezafibrate and obeticholic acid that thus far the highest rate of biochemical response has been achieved in those patients who received this combination therapy. And furthermore, we know there are many patients who have been, a lot of patients who have been on the open label extension arms of these studies that, to my knowledge and understanding, have tolerated the medication well and have done well. So I think this certainly, raises some interesting challenges for us because I'm sure you have the same situation. Have a number of patients who have been on OCA for years and doing extremely well, and now we have to figure out what to do. Fortunately, we do have other options, and so we would have to counsel these patients about this recent action, the reasons behind the concern, and then find alternative therapies for them. The fibrate question is interesting because bezafibrate arguably is the one that's best studied, and it is a pan-PPAR, so it has activity directed at alpha and delta, in addition to possibly some component of gamma that we don't know. But it's more of a scattershot approach. It's not a precise rational therapy. But there's good data with bezafibrate suggesting that it is effective in biochemical responses, and that it is effective also in relieving itch. Bezafibrate, of course, is not available in the U.S. It is available in Canada and other countries in Europe, but it's not available here. So here we have fenofibrate, with which there are much more limited data. Fenofibrate is predominantly a PPAR alpha agonist, and the lack of sort of a rigorous, carefully designed and executed development program that shows us the safety and efficacy of fenofibrate, really makes it less attractive than an approved medication such as elafibranor or seladelpar, which are approved and both were approved last year. So in my practice, I tend to use a fenofibrate for patients who have not tolerated or not eligible for or can't obtain these other PPARs. But fortunately, we have not had any challenges in terms of getting these medications. I have historically not used much fenofibrate, to be honest with you. So I don't have a lot of experience. I have a handful of patients on it. And I cannot really see a strong reason to continue them on efibrate when we have approved medications that work in a similar manner, available to use in practice. What are your thoughts? You follow a lot of PBC patients yourself.
Yeah. So I have two things very similar to you, or one similar and one different, in that I do have a number of patients on A-beta cholic acid that I'm now going to have a new strategy for. And I do have a number of patients on fibrates because they do affect anti-itching. I have some PSC patients, which is another category of cholestasis, on fibrates. For many of them, I have stopped the fenofibrate and switched them to one of the PPARs that's actually approved. Now, if they're doing well and we have that conversation, I have continued them, especially if they're in biochemical remission, just because I'm not going to rock the boat. But it's all exciting to get new tools. So no complaints. I want to steer you now a little bit towards diagnosis. So we've talked about PBC and biochemical response and some of the evolution in therapeutics, but I want to step back to actually the diagnosis. We all know that if you have cholestatic labs and you're AMA positive, especially if you fit the demographics, that we would just feel comfortable labeling you as PBC. But what do you do with that individual who is AMA negative, but you still have a strong suspicion that PBC is the explanation for their liver disease?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, if you read a textbook or read a review article, it makes it pretty clear that for that 3% of patients who are AMA negative and also negative on the disease-specific ANA testing, which is the SB100 or GP210, a liver biopsy should be performed. And I think I generally do stick to that recommendation, but now that we have transient elastography, we see a lot of patients who have a history of thyroid disease. They're in the appropriate age group for PBC. They have a positive ANA or a positive anti-smooth muscle antibody, negative with the SB100 and GP210, negative on the specific M2 antibody, a cholestatic pattern of liver enzymes, have one or two other autoimmune diseases, and have a liver stiffness that is, fairly low, 6 or 7 or 8 at most. So I think even though when you get up and give a lecture, you're more doctrinaire about you need to do a biopsy in those patients, I think a trial of UDCA for patients who you think likely have PBC, especially for those patients that I described who have the compatible clinical picture. And I have many of these patients, although they're negative on these disease-specific ANA, they have a positive ANA that is nonspecific, or they have a positive anti-gliadin or anti-smooth muscle antibody. And it's hard to know, you know, what additional benefit you're going to get from a biopsy. So I think a therapeutic trial is reasonable. Fortunately, that only applies to about 3% of patients. And I generally don't get into a big workup looking for sarcoid or infiltrative liver disease or things of that sort if they have a compatible clinical picture. But on the other hand, if it's, for example, if it's a man, no other autoimmune diseases, IgG4 is negative, cholangiogram is normal, you know, then a biopsy would be helpful. But those are the kinds of additional considerations that are important in a patient that doesn't have the typical clinical picture.
Thank you. And now we have another, you know, concept of cholestatic genetic testing. So that, you know, there's no gene for PBC that I'm aware of. Maybe, Chris, you could school me on that if there is. But I think in some of these individuals where you don't think they fit into the demographic of PBC, like the men, the young people, I think that I've been starting to order cholestatic genetic testing, which is a bane in my existence because I don't always know how to interpret the results they give. They give me results of genetic abnormalities that don't necessarily have diagnostic usefulness, but are still not normal. And so I'm collecting them and trying to figure out what to do with them. But I do think that that probably is a helpful, you know, test for a small minority of those patients that might have another reason for cholestasis. Are you using these panels?
Yes. So I think this is sort of a tip of the iceberg type of situation where you have a variety of patients who have a variety of different symptoms, whether it's intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, symptoms that seem to fit into a pattern that we used to call BRIC, benign recurrent intrahepatic cholestasis, or patients with, you know, with very severe cholestasis superimposed upon a otherwise straightforward diagnosis of PBC, we're now recognizing that BSEP and MDR3 could be very important genes. BSEP, of course, being bile salt export pump, where you can get inability to excrete bile salts into the bile canaliculus. So they present with more of a hepatocellular injury pattern, or the MDR3 mutations, which are probably the most common in adults. And there's a whole range of these mutations that leads to deficient biliary phospholipid secretion and therefore provides less protection against bile acid or bile salt mediated injury to the bile ducts. So these are the ABCB transport protein mutations. But the challenge, of course, is that with next-gen sequencing and exome sequencing, you get a variety of different, variants of unclear significance. In fact, there's a name for it, VUOS. Variants of unclear significance, and you're stuck with a lot of different SNPs that may or may not be disease causing. So I think it's no pun intended. We're scratching the surface here, but I do think that for certain patients it can be very helpful, and for patients who clearly have unexplained cholestasis, that seems to be in the range of PFIC, progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis, you can identify those patients based on history, and genetic testing can be helpful because we have approved therapies now for these diseases. And sometimes it's reassuring for the patient just to know that, quote unquote, it's not in their head. You know, they've seen a variety of other doctors who sort of dismiss their symptoms. And so just knowing that there's a potential pathogenic variant here can be reassuring and has implications for family screening and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I unfortunately have a nice collection of VUOS, so maybe someday we'll have some clarity to my collection. You talked a little bit about IBAT inhibitors or some of the other options we have, which probably, if we take a step back, there are other things that we should really concentrate on in our cholestatic patients besides just biochemical response. So when you're thinking about therapeutics and other things that you don't want to miss, what else do you look at besides just your bilirubin and your alkaline phosphatase?
Right. So, you know, we've known for quite some time that fatigue and pruritus are very important symptoms in PBC. We've known for quite some time that there are important physiologic correlates, and MR functional imaging has shown very clear differences anatomically and functionally in patients with PBC who have profound fatigue or who have severe pruritus. And, you know, once again, this is one of these situations where to be open-ended in asking the patients about these symptoms and accepting and validating their symptoms goes a long way to reassuring the patient that it's not something psychosomatic. And so we know that these are important symptoms. We know they have huge impacts on quality of life, sleep, functioning, and particularly for patients with pruritus, leads to social isolation, withdrawal, depression, anxiety, etc. So, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we often don't pay attention to these kinds of symptoms unless there's a therapy available because we can't do much about it. And especially with fatigue, you know, we've talked about using anti-narcoleptic drugs. We talk about high-intensity interval training, which, of course, when you're looking at a patient who has severe fatigue and you tell them to do high-intensity interval training, you get a look like, are you out of your mind? So you know, you have to be empathetic to the patient. You have to try everything you can. But we do have, you know, had major advances with our understanding of how bile acids undergo enterohepatic circulation. And the development of the IBAT inhibitors has really been a game changer for these rare cholestatic diseases and may have implications for itch in PBC. So for example, a number of IBAT inhibitors are approved for Alagille's, for PFIC, etc. And these drugs block the ileal bile acid transport section of the terminal ileum, leading to bile acid excretion and interrupting enterohepatic circulation and reducing bile acid burden, and have dramatic effects on itch. And particularly in pediatric disorders, they have shown improvement in outcomes, which is extraordinary. So, and what's attractive about these medications, in contrast to the fibrates and the PPARs, is that the relief in the itch occurs extremely quickly. And in fact, although these drugs do have some side effects, such as diarrhea and so forth, as I'm sure you're aware, being involved in clinical trials yourself and caring for these patients, they want to stay on the drug, even if they have side effects, because it works so well against itching. So I think the development of the IBAT inhibitors is very, very important, and it really reminds us that we have to be asking our patients about symptoms. And we all have patients, those of us that have been in practice for a long time, even if we don't specialize in cholestatic liver disease, who have such bad pruritus that it leads them to be suicidal. And historically, we used to use such pruritus as an indication for liver transplant. Unfortunately, I think with the recent changes in allocation policy, that's become much more challenging to provide that as an alternative pathway for transplant. But fortunately, it's relatively rare, and we get these IBAT inhibitors approved for itch in PBC, which they're not yet. I think that'll be a really important advance. And there are several clinical trials right now. A phase 3 trial was recently completed. Phase 2 trials are underway. Other phase 3 trials are being planned with a variety of IBAT inhibitors that I think will be really really important for patients with PBC who have severe itch, because and PSC as well with itch, because they work literally within days, and are dramatically effective, for patients. So I think that is another therapeutic area in cholestatic liver disease that has been really great to observe and be part of.
It's never a good time to be a patient with cholestasis, but I do think that there are a lot more opportunity. And also the last thing is that we always, warn our patients that they need to be cognizant of their bone health. So maybe not the high intensity of exercise, but definitely some type of, bone exercise, a weight bearing exercise, so that we keep their bone health in the forefront. Well, Chris, I cannot thank you so much for joining us for the Liver Lineup updates and unfiltered insights. I think that this has been a huge, task with all of the new changes that have occurred. We'll look forward to the combined society guideline and, maybe get you back to offer your insights when we have more options in the future. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.